You're listening to The Midday Grind with Martin Kilcoyne and Charlie Marlowe on 590 The Fan, 105.7 HD2 FM, and InsideSTL.com.
Will you partake of that last offered cup or disappear into the potter's ground when the man comes around? Hear the trumpets, hear the pipers.
On 590 The Fan, The Midday Grind. Martin Kilcoyne, Charlie Marlowe with you till 3 o'clock. Line change. Cam, TJ, the gang coming up at the top of the hour. Blues with the day off today. In case you're wondering, trade deadline has passed. And as promised, Doug Armstrong said he'd probably be sitting this one out after dealing Kevin Shattenkirk. Although we don't know that officially. Blues are in Winnipeg on Friday night. They've lost 4 in a row, so now 7-5 under the new coach, Mike Yeo. Hey, let's talk a little baseball, and with us now is Ken Obergfell, number 10 in your hearts from the days at Busch Stadium. Ken, how are you?
I'm doing good. How are you guys doing?
Hey, we're doing great. I understand you're coming back to the area, going to be doing some coaching with the Grizzlies. Tell us about the opportunity and why it made sense for you.
Well, it made sense for one because it's home. Right? I live in this area, but you know, last year I took a year off from baseball. My wife had been real sick and with cancer and that, so I wanted to be around as much as I could. And when she passed, I said, it's time for me to move back to St. Louis. I put my house up for sale in Texas, and thankfully got a bid on it quickly. So we're in the process of selling that house and coming back here, and I wanted to get back in the game. So I know Rich Sojay pretty well. He's a close family friend. Talked with him, talked with Phil Warren, and things worked out.
And I know looking up online, it says both Highland and Maryville. So which is home for you? I've seen both written.
Maryville is home. It's funny because Highland, it was like someone goes, well, where were you born? I said, in Highland, because Maryville didn't have a hospital at the time. But I think I lived in Highland at the hospital for maybe one day, and then it was back in Maryville.
Yet, but
Maryville is home.
Yet another Wikipedia myth. Ken Obergfell with us, and boy, those great Cardinal teams when Whitey came around. Give us an idea, and we've done so many different stories with Ozzy or with Whitey. When he arrived, did you have a sense, hey, this team, this franchise is going to turn the corner? Because late 70s, the Cards just were not as competitive. When did you think with Whitey, hey, we're going to be good?
When he made all those trades that year, you know, Whitey came in and said, you know, we're playing in a big ballpark. We need to try to get some speed guys and be an aggressive base running team. And when he took over and started making all those trades that one year, I said, you know, this team's getting ready to get real good.
And then he brings in Ozzy, and then Willie McGee comes along. You win the 82 World Series. You've been in the game a long time. Does anything top that moment?
None. Not absolutely nothing. It's almost, what, it's been 30-something years, and it feels like it was yesterday.
And isn't it crazy the game now? People will hit 40 or, you know, 50 home runs. Back then, you get, if George Hendrick hit 18, we all thought, wow, he had a big year. I mean, it wasn't just the makeup of your team. It was also the way the game was being played.
Exactly. It was. And if I recall, I'm not exactly sure, but I think that year as a team, we hit 67 home runs. And now, as a, you know, now as an individual, guys hit 70. So it was, you know, it was a team that Whitey made up, you know, made to fit that ballpark at the time. And you know, there was a lot of bigger parks back then than there is now. So, you know, I think you try to build your team around your ballpark, and that's what Whitey did.
So, Ken, you're going to be the Gateway Grizzlies' new hitting coach. Give us your hitting philosophy, and has it changed over the years?
Not really. My philosophy is see the ball and hit the ball. But I don't, you know, I mean, you can talk hitting for hours, but I'm the type, I try to take a young player and, you know, he's going to have his strengths, he's going to have his weaknesses, but I try to work with his strengths to make his strengths a little better, which will, you know, compensate a little bit for his weaknesses.
And you were coaching a long time, Mets organization, and I guess recently some stuff with Houston, and then you were in the big leagues with the Mets. What do you like about the coaching aspect, being with the players?
Oh, I love it. I mean, that's the thing I miss most is being in that clubhouse you know, when I was off last year, I just missed the camaraderie of the players, the coaches, the manager, just, you know, getting together. It's like a big family get together. And that's what I miss the most. And that's what I'm really excited about getting back in the game to be able to, you know, work with these young players and, you know, give them some, you know, thoughts that I have about, you know, what it took me to get to the big leagues. And hopefully we get them back into affiliated baseball and they go from there.
Yeah, and we know the story of these guys, the Frontier League, whether it's the Rascals, the Grizzlies, they're still holding on to the dream. When did it become real for you? When did you say, hey, I think I'm going to make it to the big leagues? I mean, maybe as a kid, were you running around the backyard pretending to be a Cardinal and saying one day?
Oh, always. I mean, that was my dream. Or, you know, the people say when you're a kid, what do you want to be when you grow up? And I said a St. Louis Cardinal. You know, some people want to be a doctor, a policeman. I wanted to be a St. Louis Cardinal. And when I signed with the Cardinals, that was like a dream come true. And then as it kept going, I said, you know, I got a chance someday to play for the St. Louis Cardinals. And I just worked hard at it and, you know, got a break and got a chance and made the most of it.
So did you come up with Templeton, Hernandez? I mean, there was a lot of great players that kind of emerged mid to late 70s that were from the system.
They were there already. I mean, Templeton was, you know, I signed as a shortstop. So originally my first year in rookie league, I was playing shortstop. And every time Templeton, he was a step ahead of me. When he went up to double A, I went up to A ball. So when he went up to triple A, I went up to double A. So I was going, come on, Tempe, get to the big leagues. So, yeah, you know, it was that way. And Keith was already in the big leagues. And I came up, the players that I can remember, you know, playing with most was Tommy and Mike Ramsey, Glenn Brummer. You know, some of these guys were some of my minor league teammates. And what happened, the Cardinals moved me to second base when I got to the big leagues. Or actually, they moved me before I got to the big leagues. So it was almost like, okay, Tempe's going to be in the big leagues at short. We'll move Obi to second base and make him a second baseman. And that's how it was for the first 3 years. And then Whitey came in and Tommy was ready for the big leagues, and so they moved me to third base to make room for Tommy at second.
And I don't know what the metrics are. There's so many damn numbers now with the game, but I mean, people would always say that had to be one of the best defensive infields between Keith Hernandez, Ozzie Smith, Ken Obergfeld, Tommy Herr. I don't know how we quantify it, but I would think, in your mind even, that had to be one of the best defensive groups.
I felt we were. I felt we were the best defensive team in baseball. And I felt we were our infield, not bragging on it, but, you know, we were all pretty darn good at our positions. I think we all possibly could have won gold gloves that year. But I know our pitching staff liked us behind them, and they knew if they threw the ball and hit on the ground, chances are we were going to make the play.
Ken, wondering what your opinion is on the whole pace of play idea with Major League Baseball. I'm just looking up here. You obviously came up in the 70s, and I see in 1974, the average time of a Major League game was 2 hours and 29 minutes. And then 40 years later in 2014, in 40 years, it increased by 40 minutes to basically 3 hours and 10 minutes. Do you think, is that too long? Is baseball getting to be a little too boring? What do you think about that coming from the era when the games were played much quicker?
That's a good question. You know, I'm not sure. I mean, now they have all these, you know, you can challenge plays and, you know, you got replays, you got this, you got that. You know, you don't have as much arguing with umpires like back in the 70s and 80s. But, there's a lot more runs scored, it seems like, anyway. And just games last longer. I mean, there's a lot more pitching changes because you got your starter, if he gives you six innings, then you got your seventh, eighth, and ninth inning guys. Well, you know, back when I played, our seven, eight, and nine innings was Bruce Sutter. And, you know, it could be all three innings. Where now you got so many pitching changes, and I don't know, it just takes longer, I guess.
Ken Obergfeld with us here on 590 The Fan. He'll be the hitting coach this summer for the Gateway Grizzlies. You were up for it for a little while there with the Mets. You interviewed to be the manager. Was that a post-playing dream, was to actually manage in the big leagues?
Well, I wanted to at least get to the big leagues as a coach. But, yeah, I had a desire to manage it at one time. And, you know, when I had the interview with the Mets, I mean, I pretty much knew I wasn't going to get that job, but it was a good experience for me being able to do my first interview to possibly be a big league manager, which at the time I felt, okay, this is going to give me more experience for the next time when it happens. Well, there never was a next time. So it just, you know, it was what it was. And it was just, you know, I got the opportunity to coach in the major leagues, and it was fun. But, you know, the dream of managing was done after about 2 years after that I didn't get the job.
Well, people, I would say, not just in St. Louis, but baseball fans across the country always do the ranting and raving the day after, and the manager is always the pinata. He could have done this. He didn't do this. As somebody who's been on the bench and, you know, and managed the minors, how much do you think the manager can influence the game? I mean, how many games, even out of 162, is there a number you'd place on what difference that manager could make? Because I know we spent a lot of time breaking it all down. Sometimes a guy just drops the ball. Sometimes a guy just makes a bad pitch. What do you think the impact is of the manager?
I don't think it's that big of an impact. I mean, I think possibly a manager might decide 4 or 5 games a year. I don't know what the statistics say, but, you know, that's what I say. I think the big thing with a manager is being able to communicate with his players, handle the media, and, you know, just know when to put guys in the right situation so they can have their best opportunity of having success. And that's what made Whitey so good. Whitey never really, you know, our starting lineup, he didn't really talk to us a lot. He'd blah, hey, how you doing, blah, blah, blah. But he always made sure he talked to the extra guys every day. How you doing? How's the family? He made them feel important, and he always put them in important situations.
What was your interaction with Gussie Bush? Because, I mean, famously owned the team but was friends with Whitey, and I think a lot of teams now, and Mr. DeWitt's different with the Cardinals, but the owners tend to sit up in the box. You don't see him. Do you remember Gussie Bush being around, hanging in the clubhouse?
At times, you know, at times. Not a lot, but he'd come by once in a while and say hi to everybody, and, you know, he's just a super guy. And, I mean, you know, one of the owners that I played for in Atlanta, Ted Turner, he was in that clubhouse all the time. I thought we were going to get him a uniform sometimes. But, you know, he was just super. I mean, we were like his kids. And so, you know, different owners are, you know, act differently.
And you were traded to Atlanta, so it was at the deadline, 84. It's funny, a lot of our talk here in St. Louis this week was about the NHL trade deadline and a Blues popular player getting traded out of here. What was that like for you? You'd had a long run in your hometown team, and then you find out you're going to Atlanta.
Oh, well, when I was first told, I mean, I had no idea. Usually, you know, you'll have an idea, there'll be talk that, you know, this guy is possibly going to get traded, but, I mean, my name was never mentioned anywhere, and then all of a sudden Joe McDonald and Whitey called me in and said, we just traded you to Atlanta for Ken Daly and Mike Jorgensen. And I'm like, wow, that's a shocker. And at the time, Bob Horner was hurt in Atlanta, so they needed a third baseman, and they were kind of in the pennant race. So, you know, I became an Atlanta Brave, and the more I think about it over the years since, it was the best thing that happened for me because – at the time, you know, Whitey was trying to find a place to play Van Slyke, and it was going to be third base at the time. So, but he sent me to a place where I wasn't going to be a bench player. I was still going to play on an everyday basis. So it was the best thing to happen, but I was crushed. I mean, growing up in St. Louis and getting traded from your hometown, it was pretty crushing at first.
Ken, you mentioned Ted Turner. Can you tell us your favorite Ted Turner story that you can say on the radio?
No. Well, we kind of agreed to, when I was a free agent down there, we kind of agreed to a contract talking to each other in the urinals next to each other. We kind of decided what we needed. And so that would probably be the biggest thing with me and Ted is we're both going to the restroom talking about a contract. And by the time we were done, I was signing a new contract.
I think he's still paying Al Hrabowski. There was some kind of lifelong deal or something. Though, if you get a piece of Ted's money, that was a good thing back in the day.
Well, Ken, oh, yeah. Yeah, Ted had it, and he was not afraid to spend it.
Hey, Ken, great to talk to you. We look forward to seeing you over there at the Grizzlies Park.
Well, I appreciate that. Thanks, guys.
All right, Ken Obergefell, former Cardinal, Obi-Wan back in the day, because in his heyday, of course, Star Wars is out, and it's Obi over. They did have the best defense going. Now, they didn't hit home runs, didn't have a lot of power, scored just enough runs, but you had Obergefell at third. You had Tommy Herr at second, Ozzie and Hernandez. I mean, they could, as they say, Charles, they could pick it. They could pick it.
But he also said in discussing his hitting philosophy, you make your team, you construct your team for your ballpark. And for that ballpark, that era on turf, it was the absolutely perfect team.
And somebody who managed in the minor leagues, coached in the big leagues, played in the game for, I think he had a 17-year run, played in Houston, a number of different places, between, even after St. Louis and Atlanta. His breakdown, and you hear that number thrown around, but a manager makes the difference about four or five games a year. Yet, I'm going to go ahead and say it now, we'll break down Matheny 162 in St. Louis, and the actual difference, in his opinion, would be four or five.
But how do you quantify? I understand in terms of making the right baseball decision in a game, whether it's going to the bullpen, bunting, not bunting, hopefully not bunting, Gardner, or hitting and running, stealing a base, whatever that may be. But also, Matheny, I think, deserves a lot of credit. Even if you're going to criticize some of his in-game strategy, he does seem to be a very good motivational guy. Guys like to play for him. He sticks up for his players. It seems like when a young guy comes up, that they feel a little more comfortable. Am I wrong on that? With Tony, it seemed like the younger guys kind of had to pay their dues a little more.
Yeah, I'm not sure about that.
How do you quantify that?
Yeah, how do you quantify that? I don't know. I'm not sure about him and the young guys where that falls. But, for example, he could make out a lineup and he could hit somebody second. And we would all snicker and say, oh, my God, you're hitting him second? What are you thinking? And that night the guy goes 3-for-4 and scores 3 runs. And we'll never talk about it again. So there are things that happen during the course of the year. But how do you quantify somebody that's a leader of men, which is what Mazalek always talks about, DeWitt always talks about? You know, they don't say, oh, when you come to Mike's strategy, they always talk about leader of men, keeping the group together, which is interesting since now the whole clubhouse vibe has been discussed. And Derek Gould pointed it out that it was last spring. I had kind of forgotten that they had a players-only meeting last spring to kind of clear the air, how they were as the chemistry issue that was going into the season. I had forgotten all about that. And then the Cubs win and they're the team having fun. And then this year they're going to, what are they going to, empty space houses or what do they call it? Or
safe spaces, escape rooms
and all of this. But a year ago it was already on the table, which is weird because you talk about leader of men and motivating a team more so than you talk strategy. And I guarantee if you're Matheny, that'll take you off. That's all they ever say.
Right. Is interesting, though, that they had a clubhouse meeting last year after making the postseason, what, 5 straight years? And then last year they don't make the playoffs.
So don't have a...
I just think the whole
idea... A lot
idea,
of it's overstated.
I think the whole idea of clubhouse chemistry, there's certainly something to it. Can you quantify it? I don't think so. I think it has to do sometimes with at work. Don't you like working around people that you like? If those people are pleasant, it makes your life easier. If you're working next to people you don't like and you're always bickering,
this topic is kind of uncomfortable right now.
That's true. But I'm just saying, I think we talk about clubhouse chemistry when the team's bad. And I think when the team's rolling, we don't talk about it.
And I think the majority of times when you're going to critique or rip apart a manager and it's going to be one of those 4 or 5 games where they really make a difference, I think it's almost always going to be about something in the bullpen, about a matchup. Late, and it's not going to be who you started. Although last year there was the Sunday night game in July. The poor kid, Mike, it's Mike Myers, but it's spelled Mayers. They started him on a Sunday night.
And they didn't bring Reyes up, remember?
Yeah, and I said, there's no way this guy's your best option right now. He wasn't on their radar. He wasn't in the mix for the rest of the year. He was just a guy to plug in, and it was a Sunday night game, ESPN game, and they threw him out there, and he just got shelled.
Dodgers, right?
I think it was the Dodgers. And then they left him out there. And I was convinced, whether that's a organizational decision, there had to be somebody who was better equipped to make that start. So there's one example where I would say you probably lost that game before it even started. But the majority of times that you break it down, it's going to be because of the bullpen, I think.
And I wouldn't put this on Matheny. Maybe this is more of an organizational, you know, John Mozeliak decision. But a lot of people talked last year about why was it taking so long to bring Reyes up. And I totally understand that Reyes was not dominating at AAA as a starter. But you did have holes in your bullpen. And I understand there's some hindsight with the fact that Reyes was so good when he came up to the Cardinals. But you lost a lot of games there because you couldn't have somebody bridge the gap to Sun Wan Oh. And you had problems in the 7th and the 8th. And you know what? It makes sense for a guy who's 21, 22 years old to come up in a less, in a less high leverage spot and be your seventh inning guy. I mean, that team got better when Alex Reyes was called up, and you know what? They only missed the playoffs by one game. So it's fair to say if you bring him up 3-4 weeks earlier, are you in a playoff to get to the wild card?
There's no doubt in my mind. Last year there were games that they threw away with just obviously bad decisions like the Mike Myers, and then it cost you because you didn't get in based on the one game. Ken Obergfell, part of the Grizzlies staff. Good to talk with him. Rankin Jordan is the Pediatric Bridge Hospital located in Maryland Heights. In fact, that building on Dorset, it's been over a decade now at that location. The kids helped design it. So they got out some napkins and started scribbling, and they wanted it to look like a Lego building. And if you ever drive down Dorset and you go past, it's about 2 miles east of 270, it looks like a Lego building. The architect won an award for the design. The kids picked it out. The kids had that kind of input because at Rankin Jordan, it is all about the kids. Pediatric Bridge Hospital means they go from another hospital. They could be at Cardinal Glennon or Children's, and they need the bed space. But these kids aren't ready to go home. They still need some rehab time. Could be 6 weeks or 6 months. They go over to Rankin Jordan, work with the great medical team there, eventually going back home. That's why they call it the Bridge Hospital. It's why they have that magic carpet as their logo, because they're eventually getting those kids back home. Those are the days. Lori Tanner, the CEO, Dr. Nick, they'll tell you the most emotional days are when these kids get to leave and they're going home with their family. Amazing work being done, helping these kids, various ailments across the board. You can always read their stories at RankinJordan.org. You want to get involved, you have some time, you'd like to be a volunteer, they could always use help. Upcoming events include the Go Marathon, where they're looking for folks to sign up a team. You can do that through Rankin Jordan. So if you're going to do the marathon or walk or half marathon, do that through them so they can raise a little bit of money. You can find out more at RankinJordan.org.